Good morning. I'd like to welcome everyone to the study session, Mesa City Council for Thursday, April 22nd, 2010. We'll begin with a presentation on budget issues. We'll hear from three departments today. Begin with City Courts, go on to Arts and Culture, and then Transit. Judge?
As the Chair of Audit and Finance, can we table this particular
drink?
Okay, Mayor and are we ready? Mayor, members of the City Council, we're honored here to be here today to make our budget presentation. I can just say that the way our court staff and our administrators look at everything is very positive. And the past 6 or 7 years, we've always stayed ahead of the curve in budget cuts by the use of technology, and the proof is in the pudding. I'm honored right now, and I sincerely mean this, and I didn't have to be at the microphone. I would stand to introduce an incredible staff of administrators who are going to make the presentation today. Paul Thomas, Lenny Montanaro, Janie Moreno, sitting to my right here, and Albert Lemke. At this time, we'll commence our presentation with the Paul Thomas starting.
Morning, Mayor and members of Council. You'll be relieved to know we're not here to talk about chairs this morning, so we'll start things off right.
Councilmember Summers said that he tabled that discussion anyway.
Okay.
But I told him he wasn't the chair of this meeting.
Very so. Good.
All right.
Very good. Very good. Thanks, Mayor. We'll get started with the first slide. Let me go ahead on it. I think it's always important when you talk about the court or anything we do to look at the overall load that faces the court. We're one of the large volume courts. The numbers are always important. To put things in perspective, you can see that last year, and the Supreme Court counts charges, so we had over 125,000 charges filed, which equates to about 92,000 cases. It's a pretty significant load. We have high volume numbers of people coming to the court, 273,000. That's pretty consistent in terms of people coming in and through the court yearly. We also track what we call in-courtroom events, which are things that happen in the courtroom, a hearing, hearings on a motion, something that happens in the courtroom. So when you look at 50,000 in-courtroom events per year, if you were divided by numbers of work days per year, it looks about 250 per day. It's not exactly 250 a day if you have trials and those things, but in terms of looking at an index of load. Our front counters are very busy pretty much all the time. A lot of our service is direct service with individuals coming in to make payments or reset payment plans or schedule traffic school or resolve issues. High volume at the front counters, that number is around 155,000. So when you see the large front counter at the court, that's a busy place. We have high call volume, incoming calls, people placing calls to the court, 266,000 phone calls. We are a very busy place at times. And outgoing calls from the court to facilitate any number of things, especially payment reminders and things like that, about 95,000 phone calls. So we are a high volume, very busy court. in terms of the budget reduction, we were asked to profile by city management. It's 3%. For us, it's about $200,000. That equates to three positions. When we faced the 7.5 position cut a year ago, we did everything we could in terms of reducing operating expenses to try to save positions. So there wasn't a place to go to look for money this year. So ultimately, it affects three positions. Two positions are related to the call center. And one position at the collections counter, it's a person that would be helping assist set up payment plans at the front counter. These positions are currently vacant, and we left them vacant anticipating that, you know, there would be consequences in the budget session this year. So we did not fill them, you know, in anticipation of what might happen in the budget process. So it's not bodies at this point in time, it's vacant positions. To get to the number, we also needed another 10,000 in line item reductions to meet the 3% number. So you can see the little box at the bottom, we've lost, you know, last 2 years, 10 and a half positions total. That's a pretty significant impact in terms of our operational ability. Now, what we have been able to do last several years, is we are aggressive when it comes to use of technology. I think we are pretty much unofficially recognized as a leading court in technology in the state, so much so that the Supreme Court has recruited us to help lead the effort in the development of a new state system because of our development ability and innovation when it comes to employing technology in the court environment, which is not an easy thing to do. To highlight that, which I think is important, and to make the connection as to how we use technology to compensate for the loss of positions, Lenny is here to kind of go through that with you. Lenny does a lot of the imaginative thinking about how to do this. He does the thinking. I take the risk. It seems to work most of the time. So, Lenny, take it.
Thank you. Here are a few things we've done to maintain our service to the public and relieve staff. Okay. Warrant automation, judges issue about 2,000 warrants for arrest each month, and this process has been automated. Judge issues the order, and the system now takes it from there. That saved about 60 staff hours a month. Integration of the QMatic system. With the new court building, the court used grant funds to expand the QMatic system over to the collections division. Real simple concept. Individual checks in one place, and the system takes him or her through the system, and it really cut down time in the lobby for the people that make individual appearances there. For the internet services and telephone services, I'm going to speak to them together because they're on the same platform. What we did last year, we changed the structure and language of our bond cards, and we really tried to encourage people to complete business over the web or our IVR telephone services. Now, the bond card is the document that is issued each time a traffic citation is issued, and what this resulted in, we're on track to receive 500,000 hits on our web. Our telephone calls are on track to drop from 236,000 in the customer service area to 233,000, which is really significant because when our lobby's full, we pull from the phones to serve over the people that are physically there. So this is just an example of potential savings. If the 45,000 plus people actually came into our lobby and made payments, the average transaction time is 7 minutes. 7 minutes times 45,000 payments equates to over 5,000 hours of staff time or 2.5 FTEs. If people would mail them in, that would be about half the savings, okay, because mail payments are about 3 minutes apiece. The other thing we're doing, just got that kicked off, was the outbound dialer to create calls, relief in the call center. Yeah, a collector can make about 47,000 calls a year. When this is fully employed, it will do the work of 1.5 FTEs and make about 70,000 outbound calls for collection activity, court reminders, things like that.
Let me make a point here. The positions we would be losing are positions in the call center that normally be making these calls. The implementation of an outbound dialer compensates for that and takes the place of those staff people that would be making those calls. So this project has been underway. We expect it to be fully employed around August. So in terms of loss of people, technology is somewhat taking the place of that person that makes those calls. So we are compensating for that loss of staff. Thanks, honey.
The
payment processing by staff. Historically, we had point-of-sales terminals, so people had to physically leave their workstation to process a payment, credit card, debit card payment. We've employed technology through the city's ITD, and nobody has to leave their workstation to process a payment now. That helps the staff, and it keeps the stuff, the people flowing through the lobby. The elimination of paper case files. Several years ago, we started our employment of a paper-on-demand court in our civil traffic division, and with the move to the new court building, locating and moving files throughout the three-story court building is very time-consuming and labor-intensive, so we're working very aggressively to get our criminal divisions online.
Just to finish that thought, we have successfully completely made our civil traffic division paperless. There are no case files in civil traffic, which is our high-volume court. We're moving into the criminal divisions to make them paperless as well. We have 96,000 files sitting on a shelf in our file room. So in a three-story building, it takes staff to move those files through the building. And we will be launching a scanning process to, over the next probably 18 months, scan those files, get them into electronic form so we can move the information electronically rather than move paper files through a three-story building. So we're moving pretty aggressively on that front. This was just a sampling of our efforts to employ technology to compensate for the loss of staff. The last slide involves a program that we started about 20 months ago. It was experimental to some extent. It's very unusual in terms of what courts do. We were asked to look at using electronic monitoring to help affect the jail costs. To use electronic monitoring pre-trial is pretty unique. We piloted this pretty much for the state. The Supreme Court was very interested in how and what procedures we were going to use to do this. And basically, it's a program within which if a person is held on bond and they cannot afford to post that bond, judge can release them on electronic monitoring. Jail costs about $192 for the first day and about $72 for every day thereafter somebody sits in jail waiting for their next court date. Electronic monitoring, the monitoring company charges us $7 a day to run that service. Huge savings. So when we run averages, we look at about an average savings of $1,000 per defendant for every defendant we put on electronic monitoring instead of holding in jail paying those extensive jail costs. Bear in mind, this is pre-trial. So if someone is sentenced to jail after trial, that's a different situation. But this is for all those defendants that cannot afford to post a bond, and there have been many, they qualify for electronic monitoring. We do that. So we look at our net savings after the costs and things are factored out of about $350,000, and it gives us a way to attack that jail bill where we have no other methodology to do that otherwise. So if the police decide to do a lot of arrests or sweeps or those things, we can affect that jail bill with electronic monitoring devices. We just have to put a call in for more devices if we think that situation is going to happen. So it's been a very successful program. When we looked at the budget cut scenario, 3% versus 5% would have taken us into this program, and it would not have made sense to eliminate the resources for this program because the consequential loss in savings was far more than the salaries that we would have saved in affecting the position. So this has been an important program. We do intend to keep it going and use it as much as possible. The more arrests, the more benefit you get from the program. But I'm not necessarily encouraging arrests. So anyway, this is a snapshot of our budget situation. Yes.
Councilman Fender has a question.
Sorry to interrupt your summary. I was just curious, where do we capture those, under whose budget are those savings captured or realized? Is that over in the police department, the jail costs?
Or? Right. If you recall, I believe when the police department made their budget, they actually even highlighted the new rates for the jail facility. But there are budgets there, but obviously the court has an impact on who we send. And if there's a way to divert that from sending them to the facilities, then this has certainly had an impact on that budget. This is something, these are savings we took. It's been more than a year now, right?
This has been 20 months in this program.
So, we already took some savings, you know, the first a couple of budgets ago. We've been able to maintain that. Now, we're still trying to tweak the program. It has a lot of, the monitoring side over on courts is significant as far as tracking these devices. And how many devices are out there at one time? I don't know, Albert is
the most we've ever had, I think, at one point was about 44. But we average probably 12, 15 at any one time.
So we have to be, but someone has to be on alert or monitoring so that if something, someone takes it off or it's damaged or whatever, there's an alert sent out and we have to follow up with that individual. But so far, go ahead.
Yeah, and it's worked very well. The monitoring component is the big hump to get over with this because it's no point having somebody with a device if you're not doing the monitoring. So we get a signal. Albert Lemke has been on call 24/7 for most of this time. He has a BlackBerry. When the monitoring company gets some kind of a signal, he gets an email saying that this person's battery is low. There's a strap alert, like they're tampering with the strap on the device or some loss of signal or any number of things. That requires us to then contact that defendant, find out what's going on. In most situations, it's just some kind of an issue. They've bumped it on something, the strap's a little bit loose or whatever. We have had a few people cut the device off, but that number is really, really low, and we just absorb that and keep going because the benefits are far, far outweigh those kinds of issues with this. But the monitoring function is the big resource issue for this, and that's something we have to work through to keep this program going.
And Mayor and Council, as much as we talk a lot about the jail costs, which are obviously significant, later today the Public Safety Committee is going to hear about the concept of creating a regional jail facility. And then again, what the police department looks at is not only the cost for the facility or to hold someone, but it's also, you think about it, the cost, the transporting back and forth, the manpower it takes to do that is fairly significant too. So this option even provides significant relief against that.
Yeah, there's many benefits to this program, as we've realized. For example, because of the fact we have a lot of defendants out on electronic monitoring, that reduces the jail population that must remain in jail, and that cuts down on the time with which we can get them back to court. So that jail population used to be a pretty significant number, and you'd look at 2 or 3 weeks before you could have to bring that defendant back because of the transportation issue with police. That time has been cut down within 7 days and sometimes 2 days. So that means those defendants that do remain in jail are staying there far less time because of this program, because the numbers are reduced. We can get them back quicker. That cuts that cost off. So the other benefit I would also mention in kind of closing, there's a qualitative benefit to this program in as much as if a person's out on electronic monitoring, they keep their job, they keep their family relationships, they keep their life somewhat intact, rather than losing all of that because they're sitting in jail for 15 or 20 days. That allows them to come back and somewhat remain whole in terms of their ability to do what they need to do, maybe make fine payments later because they didn't lose their job, and that benefit after the fact in terms of the defendant and what we can do. So this is a very viable program. A lot of courts around the state are looking at us, waiting for us to perfect it so that they can copy it. And we're working through all the, you know, the logistical issues to make this work. So we felt it important to put this on for today. Thank you.
Councilmember Kavanaugh.
Thank you, Mayor. I have the privilege to represent the Arizona League of Cities and Towns on the Arizona Supreme Court's Commission on Technology. And I do have to echo what Paul had said. I think it is the feeling of judges and court personnel around the state that the Mesa Municipal Court is the leader in use of technology for efficient management of high-volume courts, and really it sets the gold standard in terms of how to respond to the needs of the courts and the people who use them. So I just wanted to it's nice to go to the meetings if you say you're from Mesa. They're all a little bit jealous, and so I wanted to add my compliments to the work that you've done and all those multiple levels that really have made our courts the leader in a high-volume municipal courts. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to wade into a minefield here. Has there been any... We have a bill that's sitting on the governor's desk that will change or potentially change how we interact with suspected illegal immigrants, basically creating a state crime, which means that we will have to now process them. Based on other laws, my understanding is they're not eligible for bail either, which means we'll have to hold them. Has there been any kind of, have you begun or looked at the potential impact? Because this is an unfunded mandate. There's no money. There's just demands. It's probably a little bit too early to ask if you've looked at that, but if you haven't, I would like to know what the expectations are as we enforce this and bring all these new people into a system that both creates court issues and confinement issues, none of which are to be reimbursed to the city. What impact that'll have both on the court finances and also the holding finances. I don't know if you've even begun to consider that, but that's something we need to look at very quickly.
Well, you know, we've discussed it, but the an easy answer is it's a rule of law. We follow the law. Now, the
Judge, I know it's a rule of law. I'm asking what the financial impact will be because I appreciate your budget. The fact is that we have something we don't know what it's going to be, and if we follow that rule of law and enforce that rule of law, it's going to have huge impacts on your operations and on your budget and on the city's budget.
Especially if they're say you cannot release a person.
Well, but my understanding is the law right now is you cannot. They're not eligible for bail.
No, well, the law as it exists right now.
Yeah.
If when they come into our in-custody court, there's not an allegation that they are here illegally, but that is one of the things you look at. There's 10 requirements on conditions
of release.
But that
changes because and, the specific reason they're coming in is because under the new state law, they're either under the trespass law or they're under the failure to produce documents, whatever it is, the immigration status is the reason why they're in your court now.
Well,
that doesn't exist now because now we simply turn them over to, we turn them over to ICE, and ICE takes care of deportation.
Yeah, and there's a minimum fine of $500 that you'd have to impose, keep them in jail until day of trial, and then after that release them. That would all be jail costs if they're held all that time.
I understand that.
Yeah, so,
and,
yeah.
And I think what we need to do is once again, I remember when they changed, what was it, last year, Mr. Butler, sorry to wake you up, Scott.
That's okay, I'll be right.
When they changed the DUI sentencing, minimum sentencing, what was the impact on our budgets last year simply by changing, and I can't remember that number. Chuck?
I'll be glad to hand that one to Mr.
Thank you.
Well, and that one's not a real clear answer because they actually lowered rates last year, which was.
But I mean, it did have an impact. The idea is that a change in the law, which required.
If I recall correctly, you guys were anticipating about 1,000 extra cases that we would be forced to.
Yeah. Typically, what happens when they increase DUI penalties, you create an incentive for people to go to trial. So instead of selling it out, they have every incentive to go to trial and take a shot with a jury. So that increases our trial.
Yeah, and I just. Once again, another unfunded mandate that has a huge impact on our courts and on our budget is that, you know, it's our state legislature is very good at passing laws and passing the buck also. And I think we need to, and I wish you would, as assuming this gets signed by the governor, we don't know what she's going to do yet, but let's just say assuming, I would like a follow-up as best you can. And I don't know where we can get those numbers. But as a follow-up little footnote to this, I think we need to keep our eye out that if this is signed and it does become effective, there's going to be significant impacts to our budget because it is not funded, and that means that the taxpayers of Mesa are going to pay one way or another, either through reduced services or through increased costs, and in our situation, probably a little bit of both because more in the court and the jails will have to pay more. So if you would just look at that and come back to us when, at the time that we do have some indications of what that will be, I'd appreciate it.
We will certainly do that, Mayor, but my anticipation is that this may be a somewhat of a fluid situation based on the numbers coming from the police and how they arrest and so on and so forth.
And that's why I'm not asking you for a number now, because I understand that it's going to be real hard for us to get a handle on exactly what that is, because there will be an implementation time. We have no idea what that will be. I just know that every dollar that we take and is added to us is a dollar that is not in your budget that you presented right now.
That's correct. We're going to have to adjust
to it. It's all incremental. It's a small increment rather than a big increment.
We will monitor that because we'll have to monitor it.
Yeah. Well, okay. I'd like if we could, and I don't know what we do as far as getting an estimate, but do the best we can, and maybe over the next couple, 3 weeks, because, you know, the thing doesn't go into effect for, 90 days. So we've got some time to really look at it. But just want to keep our eye on that, because I think that has the potential of having a significant impact. I know it will on your court area, but also on our incarceration costs.
Mayor, we're always, even in the civil traffic, we're always trying to work with the police because they control what we get, so we are always asking for the projections, so we're all going to work together on that.
Okay, and I'll ask the police the same thing, because once again, none of us know where. It's uncharted territory, except for it's once again another unfunded mandate, okay. And we're going to bear the burden of that. So. We need to just be looking at that, okay? Any other questions?
Nope.
Hey, thank you so very much. Appreciate the grand opening. Excited about the things you've been doing as far as electronics. And I tell you, I will echo what Councilman Kavanaugh said and what you already know, and that is that I hear from all others that the Mesa courts are held up as a model for innovation, efficiency, and the right way to run a court. So we really appreciate that.
Appreciate the compliment, Mayor. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ms. Kent?
Good morning, Mayor and City Council.
Ms. Higgins, good to see you.
Good to see you. I'm Carrie Kent, Deputy City Manager, and also serving as the City's Arts and Cultural Director. Terry Siggins is next to me here, and behind my right shoulder are my colleagues from the Arts and Cultural Department. We're here today to present the 2010-2011 budget for the Arts and Cultural Department. We consist of the Mesa Arts Center, the Arizona Museum of Natural History, and the Arizona Museum for Youth. Over the last several years, the department's been pooling our resources to provide department-wide support. As we looked at our budget reductions, we used this philosophy to further expand this model of shared resources to achieve cost savings. Examples achieved to date on our slide before you. We've moved forward towards a single team in each of these areas who collaborate to provide department-wide support at all the institutions. Since this is National Volunteer Appreciation Week, I really wanted to mention how the arts and cultural staff have grown the volunteer program over the past couple of years. And as you can see, the hours worked and the tasks performed are significant. 60,000 hours is equivalent to about 28 full-time employees. And we truly couldn't operate our facilities without the dedication of these individuals. Also wanted to share with you some of our attendance figures over the last couple of years. We continue to attract visitors across the state and nationwide. We welcome 500,000 visitors a year to our cultural institutions. Our target for our 2010-2011 budget is about $710,000. Those are the categories in which the reductions will take place, and we'll talk about them later. We do have 3.5 full-time equivalent positions that are affected. Two of those positions are unfilled or vacant at this time. We do have 1.5 positions that are filled. However, we are leaving other positions in the organization vacant so that those individuals have the opportunity to move into those positions. The slide that you have before you on slide 6 represents the 10-11 financial resources that make up the department budget. We continue to strive to bring programming to our cultural institutions that attract audiences so that we can increase our box office and admissions, which is our earned revenue. And also our foundations and our friends organizations work closely with our staff to seek sponsorships, increase our memberships, and also grant opportunities. Well, next we'll go through some of our budget reduction strategies. First, we're looking at modifying our marketing strategies by reducing some of our traditional print media advertising and really increasing the use of electronic social media. We're also looking at shifting some of our capital-related items, which are currently funded by the general fund, to a restoration fund. And this fund is generated through the Mesa Art Center ticket sales, restricted specifically for upgrading technology and the purchase and the installation of capitalized equipment. We did have some remaining capital dollars that were funded by the general fund, and we're shifting that completely to this restoration fund. And those items include things from floors, soundboards, lightings, ticket, computer, our ticketing computer system upgrades, and so forth. We're also continuing to seek partnership opportunities with our performing live artists and presenters, some of our resident companies that perform at the Art Center, like the East Valley Children's Theater, for on-campus workshops and presentations for our school children in lieu of producing our own stage work productions. Our stage work revenues have dropped significantly this year, and we feel between the artists, the presenters, and our resident companies, such as the Children's Theater, Shakespeare, and so forth, that we feel there's partnership opportunities to still engage and have youth performances on campus. We're also met with the Mesa Arts Foundation, and they are going to be assisting us with funding our youth education outreach programs, which is where our instructors go out into the schools and provide arts education, festivals, as well as lunchtime concerts that were previously funded by the general fund, and now the foundations will help us in funding those for 2011 as well. We'll continue our consolidation efforts of our Art Center box office and registration. These were two areas that were actually in separate buildings at the Art Center. You had, if you wanted to register for a class or purchase a ticket, you had to go to two separate areas on campus. This year, we've consolidated the staff, perform cross-training, so you go to one specific area, and you can either buy a ticket or register for a class from these individuals, and so that's achieved some cost savings for us as well. The budget reductions also reflect about three exhibits in our Mesa Contemporary Arts that we won't be able to fund. However, we have a very dedicated team of individuals over at the Contemporary Arts Museum who are determined to fundraise and restore those three exhibits, and I have a feeling they're going to achieve that this year. So that's something the staff's working on. We have about four shows we think that will, as part of our budget reductions, that we'll be reducing in our performances in our Performing Lives series, as well as some of our savings came from reassigning some job responsibilities and reducing our contract later. So with all of those strategies, we were able to achieve the $710,000, which is 7% of the entire Arts and Cultural Department budget. I did want to highlight just some exciting opportunities that our community will have next year to visit our institutions. As I mentioned earlier, we're projecting over 500,000 visitors to come to our art centers and our museums, and we wish to further grow our audience to further educate, entertain, and engage everyone. We have a number of outstanding partnerships. Target Corporation has once again agreed to sponsor Three for Free, which means the first Sunday of every month. If you go to our Mesa Contemporary Arts Museum, Natural History Museum, or Museum for Youth, you will get free admission, and those Sundays are extremely popular in our community. Blue Cross Blue Shield has agreed to sponsor another series of National Geographic Live, and John Michael Cousteau, son of Jack Cousteau, will visit our Mesa Art Center next year, sharing stories about the career and life of his father as well as their ocean adventures together. So we're excited about that opportunity. We also want to continue our Shop Mesa Get the Arts program until next calendar year, December 31st, 2011. As you recall, this is a program that rewards consumers for shopping in Mesa. Consumers bring their receipts to our MAC box office, and the sales tax will be matched up to $200 per visit. And these vouchers can be used on select performances at our Mesa Art Center, as well as admissions to our museums with a purchase of a ticket at a regular price. We have issued over 60,000 Mesa bucks this year so far, and about $15,000 have been redeemed. We're working with some of our resident companies on campus, which includes our Shakespeare and Symphony and other theater troupes, and involving them in the Mesa Brooks program so they can have two-for-one opportunities to see those performances as well. We're going to be focusing heavily on our youth education program. As I mentioned, National Geographic Live, every presenter that comes to the Mesa Arts Center actually has a school show during the day where we invite and fill up the Akita Theater with 1,500 school children, which is exciting opportunities that will continue. Jazz at Lincoln Center with... Yes, I'm sorry.
Councilmember Kavanaugh's question.
Thank you, Mayor. Carrying to that point of the youth outreach program, I want to let you know the Mesa Arts Center Foundation did have good news last night. We got a confirmation that Southwest Ambulance will continue its major sponsorship of our youth outreach program to the schools. They were one of our largest sponsors this year, and they've committed for this next year as well.
That's wonderful to hear.
That's latest off the press.
Thank you. And as I mentioned, Jazz at Lincoln Center with Wynton Marcellus will be coming to the Mesa Arts Center. And Jazz at Lincoln Center has a whole youth curriculum in which we'll be partnering with them and doing a music and history program with the public schools and then inviting them to performances at our Arts Center. We'll focus on youth classes as well as arts camps. The summer and spring camps at the Mesa Arts Center have been extremely popular this year, and we're going to continue that focus next year. We'll feature, again, local and national artists at our Mesa Contemporary Arts Galleries. We'll continue our preservation efforts at our Mesa Grande Ruins and efforts to open it up on a regular basis for public viewing. Additional highlights, we have some new exhibits that will be occurring at our Museum for Youth. Currently, we have Play Ball, the Cactus League Experience, in which we're partnering with the Mesa Historical Museum. It's currently there now through November, but they will be back again next fiscal year in February in time to open up again for spring training. And Play Ball captures the flavor of our spring training baseball in Arizona through photos, memorabilia, and interactive games. Jump to Japan is another exhibit that we're getting from on loan from the Minnesota Children's Museum, which introduces visitors to Japanese culture through hands-on activities and art forms from animation, comics, woodblock prints, and traditional scrolls. And then also the Smithsonian has a traveling exhibit, a Nassau exhibit, that will be coming to the arts to the Museum for Youth in October, and they're celebrating their 50th year anniversary. And so they'll be featuring paintings, drawings, photographs, sculptures, etc., from the Nassau program over the last 50 years. And then also a number of festivals that will still be occurring on our Shadow Walk, including Dia de los Muertos and Holiday Arts Festivals. The box office staff and our finance staff and marketing staff will continue to support our Art Center's resident companies, as well as our Mesa Arts and Cultural Festival, which is MacFest. And then we'll continue downtown partnerships. One of the things that we're going to continue looking at is dinner and a show packages and working with our downtown restaurants and partnering them with shows that we're having on campus. So a lot of exciting things that that are in store for the community and the rest of the state and the nation as they come and they visit beautiful Mesa and our cultural institutions. So with that, I'll open up for any questions.
Councilmember Richens.
Recently I had a constituent mention to me that Bank of America will pay for either their employees or customers to attend local museums, and they have to be on a certain list, and that ours are not on their list. So I was just going to suggest that maybe we look into that Bank of America program. They're actually a huge supporter of the arts and culture nationwide, and so
we will make
we have great museums, so we should check on that and get that on the list.
Councilmember Finter.
Really want to express my appreciation, especially on the outreach to the community and the schools. I had a lot of feedback over the last couple of years, and I know there's a tremendous amount of effort going there. There is such a resource when you talk about parents and their children and the performing arts. Their checkbooks are open. They're willing to spend. Just try to figure out how to get those out of the school auditoriums and more down towards downtown and putting those. But wonderful, and I know there's the foundation's doing that great work and the Arts Center, so thank you so much for doing that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you. This is, we're looking at something that is part of our community. I know sometimes when we're in really tough budget times, the question is, or the accusation is that some of these activities are frivolous. And I think that as we found out, especially, and I'd like to echo what Councilmember Fender says, our youth outreach You know, there are paybacks that aren't on this sheet right here, especially with the youth, that go far beyond arts and culture. And I think that last year the police department gave a very good presentation about begging us to please not affect those youth programs because of the impact it has when those don't exist. And I think that's it's important that we recognize that there are paybacks other than just nice things to do. I think it's important to also realize I get a lot of criticism leveled at the ARC Arts Co. Say, gee, nobody goes. Well, what was the number again you said?
Over 500,000.
Over 500,000 people took part in arts and culture activities in our complexes last year. That's more than our population. So it tells me that these are a very valuable community asset, and I recognize that that we're working on a razor-thin budget, and we're trying to maintain many programs. We're not expanding programs. We're just trying to get through this this valley so that we can hopefully have some continuity, and that these things don't go away altogether. So I appreciate your efforts. Thank
sure.
you.
Sure thing.
Okay.
Thank you.
Next item, transit. Mr. James.
All right. Good morning, Mayor, Council. I'm Mike James with Transit Services. Also with me today is Julie Howard, our transit coordinator. And this is our follow-up budget presentation. We wanted to go back and look a little bit. We discussed a couple weeks ago a lot about the impact of the loss of the Local Transportation Assistance Fund, or LTAF, as we like to call it. But before we get to that point in time, just wanted to emphasize that before we got that sweep from the state, our transit estimated cost for next year was under budget.
Under budget for that. What is the, if you have the numbers, what is the current year transit budget?
It's $10 million.
Slide. You're talking about 9-10?
Yeah, you're saying 10-11. I'm talking about 9-10.
Oh.
Current year. Not upcoming year, current year.
For this current year, I guess.
What's the budget for the current year? Do you have that number?
It's just under 10. Just a little bit.
Well, what you're saying is that the original proposed budget for 10-11 was basically flat.
Correct.
From 9-10. We didn't show any.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very small increase. Okay. Go ahead.
So going back, our transit budget was about $10 million, and our estimated cost when we looked at our initial service contracts was about 9.5 or 9.6. In addition to that, you know, we looked at the 10% reduction for a department, which in this case was about $900,000, which we were able to cover with additional light rail fares that were coming in. So with the 10% reduction, the light rail fares, we were looking at actually having a fund balance, which was positive back to the city. That's really when the state legislature impacted us, as you'll see on the next slide, with a loss of nearly $2 million. Had the legislature not swept that LTAF funds, we would be not talking about service reductions. We would be keeping status quo operations and moving forward with our transit program. But being as it is, we've discussed several categories for service reductions and wanted to walk through a couple of these and get some direction, if we could, for moving forward. On this first slide, you'll see since the last couple of weeks, we've been meeting with our adjacent cities to coordinate service reductions that they're doing as well as things that we are proposing. Please ignore the first bullet where it says Sunday. It should say Saturday. These are all relating to the Saturday trips on Gilbert Road. The numbers are correct. It's just that should say Saturday because we don't run Sunday service on Gilbert Road. We looked with Gilbert and Chandler. We looked at the ridership, and we tried on some of these routes, we tried to find a break point where ridership really dropped off. And you're going to see in several of these where those drop-offs takes place. On Gilbert Road, trips before 8 a.m. on Saturday and after 7 p.m. you know, we're really running very, very few people, if any, on some of those runs. So we think it makes sense to eliminate those trips after those times. And then you can see on an average Sunday, or on an average Saturday in this case, you know, we're serving 188 people, but it's really not in those early or late times. So we feel comfortable with those types of changes. The next route that we've been discussing is Southern Avenue. This one's a little more difficult. As a transit professional, I would tell you that 60-minute service is not good. Yet one of the things we're looking at is either eliminating Sunday service on this route or reducing to that 60-minute headways. I think this is a little bit of a different situation because Southern is our highest ridership route, individual route. And this exact question was put was presented in Tempe when they were looking at their budget reductions, and at least the Tempe residents had a significant objection to losing the service altogether. They really wanted to keep at least the lowest level or 60-minute service. So we're going to be asking the same type of question in our public meeting next month. But if we could get some direction on this item, that would be very helpful at this time. Okay. Going to the next slide, we have, again, on the Williamsfield Road route. This is a route that travels along Chandler Boulevard, then Williamsfield Road, and basically turns around around ASU Poly. So we're really just a small portion of this trip.
And so that's determined by basically Gilbert and Chandler.
Correct. We looked at the ridership. Again, these are places where the ridership really drops off. They're small, but they're savings that we think are prudent with the ridership and the financial situation of the cities.
Okay.
So looking at 1 through 9, depending on where we fall out on Southern Avenue, we have a range of savings between $136,000 to $255,000.
So, Mike, if you eliminate the service, is it a higher number? And if you go to the 60-minute, is it the lower number?
That is correct. Yes.
All right.
Okay. And for a lot of these things, I know we have a tendency to really get into details here, and I sort of see that as transit professionals' job. There are policy issues. You know, the elimination of service is more of a policy. Whether you run it 60 minutes or 30 minutes or whatever, I'd sort of like to leave it to you simply because that's a decision that I'm going to come back to you. If it works, great. If it doesn't work, we're going to ask why. And so if we could concentrate on the policy issues as far as where we're going to provide service, and because I think that's what we get our biggest feedback on. The service frequency is really, and the regional routes are basically, we have to be in line with our neighbors, and it's a numbers game, as far as I'm concerned. You know, if people aren't riding, then we shouldn't be running buses, and that's really a decision for those who run the system. They should be making that already without even asking us. So, okay. Councilmember Summers.
I'm not so sure about that. I wonder if they're not riding, and the question is why. If they're riding because it's a 50-minute frequency, then it's a convenient alternative to using your car. But if we run one-hour service, nobody's going to ride it. It's not service. You can't use the word 60-minute and service in the same sentence.
I agree with you. And I think if you're going to that type of thing, it becomes more of a policy issue. Because the question is, at what point in time is infrequent service equal to no service? So
you miss a bus in 50 minutes, yeah. You catch the next one. You miss a bus with 1 hour service,
I would
see you tomorrow.
Right. I think we're talking on the fringes here, but I would agree with Councilman Reserve if it's that drastic. So okay. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Vice Mayor.
Since you're going to throw that out there, I'm going to go the opposite direction because even though 60 minute from a professional standpoint is terrible, you have significant ridership on that line, and to totally eliminate that on Sunday for that significant amount of riders who use it, I think that you're going to find an awful lot of them are going to adjust to that schedule if they have used it so significantly. 60-minute head time is terrible, but if Tempe is looking to keep the 60-minute head time, we have such significant ridership, I think we need to at least keep that 60-minute head time in there. So we're going to have differing opinions on this, but it's not good, but yet because of the numbers, we need to keep that in.
Okay. Moving on, we have some additional savings coming through mid-year next year. One of the things we've been talking about for several years is an in-person assessment for Dial-A-Ride. Part of implementing that program is a program in which we provide free bus and rail passes to all the ADA-certified individuals. And by doing that, there's a small shift, but one that's significant for our budget in the long term, of diverting those typical Dial-A-Ride trips to bus and rail. There's also, through that in-person assessment, opportunity to do travel training and let people know and aid in their use of the bus and the rail system. So over 6 months, we're expecting to see $170,000 savings there, which is very good. And we think over the long term that number will grow. Additionally, Metro has been asked by the City of Phoenix to implement additional operation savings, and this $38,000 represents Mesa's proportional share of some of those savings. We don't know exactly what those are going to be yet. Steve Banto and Metro are working on those right now. The next slide here, I wanted to give a little bit of some background on the Main Street Link and local service. As we talked last time, there are two distinct delivery methods, one being local service, the other being a limited stop express, really focusing on a new set of riderships. I'm very happy with what's happened with Link since we started running it. About a year ago, we were around 18,000 trips per month, and you can see just last February, we're up to about 32,000 trips. So that ridership continues to be growing. I've got some other graphs that will show that. If you think about the Route 40, the Main Street route, this is really the red line. These are the tried and true bus riders that for many, many years got on the red line along Main Street somewhere west of Gilbert Road and rode into all the way into Phoenix or as far as up to Metro Center in the city of Phoenix. So these were a long route, very tried and true bus ridership. And we don't really see this route growing, but it's very steady. And as you can see, as you saw in the last slide, one of our higher ridership routes. So very tried and true local bus ridership on the Route 40. And has been for many, many years. The Link, interestingly, as a new system, is continuing to grow. We've got great new buses out there, express stop services, new enhanced stations, and it's really a word-of-mouth type of advertising that's going on with this system, and we're seeing the results. The blue line is really the total of the weekday, Saturday, and Sunday. And it's continuing to rise. So we're gonna keep watching that and see how high we can get that, hopefully. Coming before you today, our recommendation is to maintain the existing weekday service in this corridor. The reasons are we've got high ridership. Our Link ridership is growing. There's some technology improvements to our transit signal priority that we haven't even got fully installed yet, so we haven't really seen the benefits of that yet. And lastly, you know, these two routes support our request to the FTA, or the Federal Transit Administration, for extending light rail to Mesa Drive. I think we could be in an awkward position asking to move our light rail project forward on a corridor where we're removing significant service. So that would be staff's recommendation for those two routes at that time. Now we can continue to look at this as we need to with our financial situation. But again, because of our financial situation, we did look at some of the service that wasn't performing as well. And right now, on the weekend on this corridor, we basically have 20-minute service, or three buses per hour. We think we can reasonably cut back to 30-minute service in the corridor by doing that one of two ways. We can either alternate a Link bus and a local Route 40 bus, or we can just operate the 30-minute local bus route. And that's for our presentation, that the savings, the $253,000, that's what we've assumed for our recommendation here. Moving to the next category, delays to new service. We have some new service coming into the city, and there is an opportunity to realize some cost savings by delaying the implementation of those routes. Now, the real key with these new services is that this is a one-time savings, because you delay it once, there's a savings. The next year, you've got to fill that gap in funding for what this is helping this year.
But you make a point, and I think what this one thing, when we're talking transit, we have to realize that hopefully a lot of these things are temporary. I don't know that it's so much one time, but if we're talking about reducing services, for example, it's to meet a current situation. Long term, if ridership improves, or if financial conditions improve to where we can bring these services back, you know, we should be pointing in that direction. It seems like a lot of times with transit, we talk about a temporary change in things, and all of a sudden everyone goes crazy because they think that's permanent. Now, some things may be permanent, but most things we're talking about, I think, are temporary type changes to get us through the next year, the next 2 years, however long it may be. And perhaps we need to put that into context, because I hear way too much about if we change this, that's a change forever. I honestly think we should change some things we were doing 10 years ago to meet the new realities, and we're going to get to this right now, because I think it creates some pretty bizarre gaps in our system, because we're so fixed into here's how we've always been doing it, and if we change it somehow, the change is forever. So I think everything we're doing, we look at getting two scenarios. One, where we are now in our reality we face now, and number two, with recognition that hopefully our reality now is not a normal situation, that economy recovers, which means we have more people who get used to riding on transit. They ride, and we can return to maybe normal or even expanded levels of service in a year or two.
Mayor, but we understand. We just want to make clear to council that, assuming that doesn't happen,
right? No, we understand.
We will have to revisit this again.
Right.
This one specifically.
And next year we'll look at what our reality is then.
Right.
And we'll make another decision as to whether we're going to implement the service. And the next year after that, if we don't, then we'll look at what our reality is then. And that's what I'm saying. We should be looking every year as to where we are in the overall scheme of things, and put this in context, rather than, number one, saying this is only a 1 year, because I agree. We're going to have to look. Whatever we do here, we're going to have to sit down 6 months from now, 12 months from now, and say, okay, where are we now? Just like we did last year when we had this almost exact same conversation. And we'll have it again and again. So it is an ever-changing paradigm. I get that.
Okay, thank you.
Councilmember Higgins.
Yes.
I don't understand that slide. I don't understand. Is it you're saving $503,000 if you delay the entire route by 6 months, and then you save another $580,000?
No, these are all or. All of these.
And actually, we're not. Let's put it this way: savings is a misnomer. We are not saving money.
No.
We're not spending money. There is $503,000 budgeted.
No, there's $1 million budgeted.
Okay, there's $1 million. All right, there's $1 million budgeted to begin this on July 1, 2010. Correct.
Correct.
On
Power Road. And if we don't start it, that means we're not going to spend
$1 million.
And then these are the three alternatives as to what will happen if we, so it's budgeted, but we haven't spent it. So these aren't savings. Either just do we spend it or do we not spend it?
Mm-hmm. To be a little bit more technical, these are Prop 400 funds that if we delay the implementation, these funds will be used to fund other existing local service.
So you actually have this $1 million of Prop 400, you're going to use it for some other part of the city.
The public transportation fund has these dollars.
Right, but Mike, the point is, if we don't do it, it is a net. You can use those dollars for some other project.
Yeah, that's a little. I think that's a little too technical.
Don't get that. Okay. The point is that
what we're saying is that we have $1 million budgeted to run a line on Power Road.
That's correct.
And you're offering us three alternatives. One is to delay that implementation by 6 months, which means we won't spend $500,000 on that line. The other one, number two, is, and I'll let you explain that in more detail, is sort of a, a, a slight change from that, but the same concept. And number three is to completely delay the implementation of that for an entire year, which means we have $1 million that is now freed up to cover other expenses. We're not going to spend it on the Power Road line, right?
But we're going to spend $1 million.
Yeah, we're going to. Yeah. But it's not going on.
It impacts the shortfall.
It impacts shortfall.
Okay. I'll go to the second bullet. This was an option that surfaced where possibly we could delay the Power Road 6 months, then just operate the southern portion of the route between Superstition Springs and the Mesa Gateway Airport. When we looked at the savings and the loss of not getting to the Red Mountain campus of MCC, the additional savings to do that really didn't make sense. We're not recommending that. And then the third option is just delay it for a year. We're not recommending that as staff as well. We are recommending a delay of 6 months as bolded.
To ask another question.
Please.
I didn't understand what you just said.
Okay. Yeah. You need to explain what this number two is, because I don't think everyone.
Okay. Yeah, I don't.
There's really a two-part option. The first is we just delay implementing this for 6 months. Then when we do start running the system, we would only run between Superstition Springs Center and south to ASU Poly and the airport.
Explain. We call this a Power Road run, but explain to everyone how the run would go along Power Road. It's really two separate runs.
It is in the mid. Yes.
Go ahead.
In the midpoint of this route, we have a transit center at Superstition Springs Center. So, going north and south, that bus would come into that transit center to make connections with the other routes, as well as express buses. And then head south, and then go north. It was run as a typical.
So a bus doesn't run up and down Power Road. What it does is it runs from Gateway to the center at Superstition Springs, and from there down to Red Mountain. And when it comes back, it does
right.
the same.
Well,
thing.
Well, right now, how far does it go? I mean, there is a bus that goes to Main Street,
right.
on Power Road. Yes or no?
This service does not exist right now.
Yeah,
there's a bus that runs on Power Road.
But not in this service. Not on this line.
Okay. It just runs between Main and Superstition,
well,
right?
University turns south at Power Road and goes down to the
so
hospital.
So you can pick up a bus on Power Road at University.
Right, but not north of University.
And there's no way we can have that bus go two more miles to go to Red Mountain campus. This is a whole additional number, another line that you want to add. I mean, that we're talking about adding. But have we looked at the option of what it would cost just to go up and catch the college?
We have actually studied that in the past. And actually, we used to go out to the multi-generational center as one of the directions. So that is an option we could look at. But we think the Power Road route is a better solution because it connects MCC, the mall, airport, ASU Poly, all within one system.
Well, obviously it's a better solution, but if you're not going to give them any service, some services I always think is better than no service. So is there an option there for what that would cost to get up there or not?
We have those costs. We can get those. I don't have them with me right here.
I guess so. What you could, and then I agree with Councilman Herrings, but what we, in the sense that service could be beneficial, but the question begs the question. We don't have service right now.
Right.
People are getting from here to there, or they're not going right now. And I think, put it in perspective, we're talking about adding service in a time when we're also talking about cutting service in other areas. And the question is it advisable to add service while we're cutting elsewhere, or can we just ask people, listen, we get it that there's a long-term need, but you might have to get by for another year, which you're already doing right now. I mean, you could argue that. And that's, frankly, that's what I would argue, is that we need to look very carefully as we're adding services to whether that need truly is rises to the level of being essential, because people are making do right now. And that's not a great situation. That stinks. But once again, that's our reality right now. And I think that's what we have to look at, especially as it relates to Red Mountain campus. I have different feelings about Gateway, because I think it's just ludicrous to run a public transit system at any level and not connect to your airport or a major university. I mean, I think that's a gap that is just glaring in it, and it points out the weakness of our transit planning, where we're running routes that we've run for years, and years ago we didn't anticipate a major university or the airport running like it is, and so we didn't fill that gap. That to me is why we need to have this discussion, because the question is that not having a bus connection to Polytechnic and the airport back to the transit center, is that rise to the level of being essential? To me, you could make a good argument that, yeah, it does. That's a glaring gap in our system. I'm not sure if you have the same argument going anywhere else in the city, because there are alternatives. Councilman Higgins, or Councilman Summers.
Is there a shuttle up to?
No.
So they don't do, so MCC doesn't do a shuttle?
No.
Oh, at Red Mountain?
Yeah. No.
No, but with the amount of students at Red Mountain campus, it's hard to believe that. I mean, we're trying to connect all the kind of colleges together, yet we don't, and it's a community college, which typically is that feeder group where you don't have people with cars and So
what are they doing now?
They're probably walking 3 miles.
Driving.
I think they're driving.
We have had many, many calls of amazement that they can't get children to the community college.
I agree with you that long term that'd be a great service to have. I'm wondering, I have an answer. I'm just wondering how essential that is.
Well, I think that I think it's as essential as what you just explained about the service gap from an airport to a transit center. Someone flying into Gateway, I really don't think is looking for public transit to get to light rail to get to downtown. I mean, I just don't see that.
Okay. All right. Vice Mayor.
Well, since we're talking about the history of why we still have some of those routes, gone through these discussions year after year on transit, and we were always told before that once a bus route is in place, by law, we can't eliminate it because of certain guidelines, and yet now I'm hearing that maybe we can. So what changed? I'm just curious.
Really, the direction that we've gotten through the Federal Transit Administration and the City of Phoenix is because of the financial hardship going on nationwide, they are relaxing the Title VI conditions relating to serving minority populations. So we at this time, because of the dire financial situation, we actually are given some more leeway in eliminating service if there's a financial hardship.
Okay, because the desire was there in years past that we needed to change some of those routes, and we were always told, no, we can't. But now there is that possibility, because the power corridor, I think, is a much stronger need than possibly some of our others, and that maybe we need to look at shifting some of that.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that Power Road, because of, the way it's developed, is an underserved area, and is the future. I mean, that Power Road is going to be, already is, and it's going to even grow in its importance as far as both an educational with the Power Knowledge Corridor and an economic base and center. And I think we need to do everything we can to see if we can improve service there, if that's possible. I get it. It may not be possible right now, but we certainly need to be moving toward that situation.
So then what is our timing, our time frame, as far as we're through budget cycle, and when we set routes, what is our timing as far as being able to modify some of these routes? Do we have to just do it yearly? How can we adjust them?
Well, when we're implementing a new route such as this, it's not something that necessarily has to go through the public process, because we're not eliminating service, but we need to tell RPTA in a timely way whether or not we want to start running this service coming up in July, or we want to wait a couple months.
Well, I'm talking about possibly eliminating some other service that would make it possible to do this sooner.
Well, one of the things, we are actually looking at some different delivery methods for some of our lower ridership routes, Mesa Drive or Stapley. We have an efficiency working group with RPTA where we're actually going to, we've got the data, we're evaluating the data to see if we can potentially turn those two routes into one route, still serve the key activity centers. So we're looking at some options. We we can bring that back. I don't want to promise a time because we've got to work with our partners, but that's something that we are working on.
Because I would be in favor. Now this is the opportunity, because again, for years and years we've gone through this and we said no, we can't change, but this is our opportunity to make some modifications that will allow us to do service elsewhere because of the limited funds.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you this. Putting this in perspective, we're talking about $500,000 versus $1 million in monies that are now not earmarked, but directed toward Power Road. Let's say that we said, no, we're going to start at July 1st. What happens then? What's the alternative?
The alternative is we've got to find additional savings.
You don't have those identified right now. You're hoping, you're proposing this with the hopes that this is what you get to work with. But if the council came back and said, no, it's important enough, we want you to start on July 1 with the full-blown Power Road, then we'd be in a go back to the drawing board and try and scramble to pick up.
Yeah, and we do have options. We, as we presented earlier, there's elimination of some of our Saturday 60-minute service we could look at.
But Mayor, it seems to me you're going to have to do an awful lot to pick up $1 million.
That's exactly right, Mayor. You really have two options. And as unfortunate as it is, and I don't think anyone, you know, has fought harder on bringing these regional routes and keeping them in line through the regional process than, you know, the folks sitting here. So it's not a painful – I mean, it is a painful decision to say this, but if your option – is to either delay service that does not exist today or dramatically impact existing service and existing riders, that's why a lot of our recommendation is built around delay of implementing new service. And while at the same time obviously looking at cost efficiencies and directing resources on existing routes where ridership justifies. But when we're trying to plug such a huge unexpected hole from the state, it just makes it very difficult to shift that burden so dramatically onto existing routes.
Yeah, because as you're looking at it, I mean, even with eliminating Saturday service in this, you're looking at $100,000 here, $120,000 there. You know, all of a sudden, you look at making up even $500,000, and you know, where do you find the other reductions that at most each one's going to give you $120,000? It seems to me like now you're looking at drastic changes in the existing system, especially right. If you go to get $1 million.
Right. And Mayor and Council, I think that puts Council in a very difficult position. Recall, this is a resource issue, and we can either cut or we can look at other areas in the general fund. What I would ask the Council to do, there are very difficult decisions. We are trying to at least get the range of options of we're going to, you know, based on what's been presented today, I'm assuming the additional, the $208,000 for the additional ADA and rail savings is doable. The Main Street link and local, I didn't hear a lot of comments about that. That's $253,000. Even if, and I still heard there's a little discussion about Southern, whether we go to the 60-minute or we eliminate it, but even if we kept it, that's still $136,000. So you've come up with, you know, almost $600,000 between those three. We're trying to get to $1.3 million. Right, overall. So at the end of the day, we're short about $717,000. What we need is the next option, because there are public processes that are moving forward, to at least identify if we can't find those funds, what would that next project be? We are working diligently as possible, the staff is, between now and the time this budget is adopted, to try to close all gaps where we have those. I can't promise you that we would be able to do that, but give us a chance. Because essentially, if we can find $700,000, we save $1 million route. That's what it comes down to.
Seems to me like we have three options. We can either find additional resources, which
is it likely?
Yeah, we're still not sure that we've plugged the whole gap
right. For
budget-wise for the general fund. So we're still scrambling to get up to even ground.
Right.
All right. Or then it comes down to delay new service or cut existing service or adjust existing service. Is that accurate?
That's pretty simple.
I mean, on an overall basis,
right.
You know, whether it's this route, that route, this service or that service, we're really we either find the money somewhere or we decide not implementing new service at this time or if we decide to implement that new service, the money's got to come from somewhere, and it would have to come from existing service. I want to make sure that I'm accurate on that.
Yes, that's correct, Mayor. We're bringing forward a proposal that's based on the premise of delaying.
Yeah, the staff's recommendation is that we delay the implementation of new service, and also adjust, not completely, but we also implement, and we also you're sort of proposing a hybrid. Mm-hmm. You're saying a partial delay of implementation up there. One of the, if I'm reading this right, really a delay of 6 months is what the staff has recommended. Mm-hmm. Plus adjustments to existing service. So you're looking at a hybrid approach to that.
We are.
Okay. All right, Vice Mayor.
And as we go to look at these routes, because it's critical and it affects people, that's the bottom line, can we get a report that will tell us where our lines run, what the head times are, what our ridership is, so we can get a better grasp on what we actually have now? And that will help us in trying to determine what we need to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Mayor and Vice Mayor, one of the things, too, and we'll just be, you know, honest to this fact, is that we're just, in a sense, putting a Band-Aid over a problem. Because, I mean, we'll get to this a little bit later, but as we've discussed a lot individually, the fact that the state has now permanently eliminated one-fifth of the city's transit operating budget into perpetuity, not for a year, not for 2 years, but into perpetuity. And the problem is we can't continue business as planned. When you say business as usual, business as planned, losing such a dramatic amount of resources into the future. So we know that there are going to be structural changes moving forward, and those hard decisions, luckily, because of the ability to delay partial delay of new service and because of unexpected revenue from light rail, have allowed us to really Band-Aid over the situation for the current year. But over the next year, until we're back here a year from now talking to you about service adjustments as part of the FY12 budget, will be to look at this holistically, knowing that in order to structurally change, you have to look at all the routes, including re-examining Main Street, as several folks have commented on, looking at headways and other things along Southern and all of our other routes. So,
and again, for us to be able to really discuss those and be able to make a decision, because we're asked to make decisions that are going to be affecting people very seriously, a heavy impact, mm-hmm. We really need to have that data available to us. We need to know where each route is, timing, ridership, the whole bit, so we can intelligently discuss it.
Absolutely. And that's part of the frustration that I think we all share, Mayor and Vice Mayor, is that because of the timing of the state's action, we are really having to go through the federal process as quickly as possible to get a workable solution in place, right, as soon in the budget year as possible. This really is going to take a longer, more detailed examination of where we need to direct our resources to get the most bang for the buck. And unfortunately, the state dictated that time frame this year more than we did. So we're going to really have to do exactly what you're describing.
Yeah, but this is data that shouldn't take long to get, and we can help be part of that input if we see it.
We have the data, and we have comprehensive reports on all of our routes from Valley Metro, but there is some additional work to get some of the specific financial ridership impact for it that you need.
And that includes the connections outside our borders, too. Mm-hmm.
Councilmember Summers?
On that last point, we're talking about a $1.3 million reduction that we're looking at. How much of that reduction crosses jurisdictional lines with Chandler, Gilbert, Tempe specifically? How much of that dollars in dollars? How much of it is all in Mesa, and how much of it is impacted? For example, the Southern Road.
It is all in Mesa, but it's tied to their...
Right. Connection. Some of it's tied to it. Some of it's not. Power Road isn't really tied to it, but Southern Avenue, the 60-minute thing, those reductions are dictated in part by Tempe.
Yes.
Isn't that number 300,000? 300,000 is being cut in preparation.
Councilmember Summers, items, the first nine items in the presentation...
Question.
are really what we're calling the regionally driven solutions. Those were developed in consultation with our partners. Besides Southern Avenue, depending on the headway or lack thereof on Sunday service on Southern, that's really the only policy decision, as we're describing it, to the mayor's point of saying this is really regionally driven. We've looked at ridership. Mike and Julie believe that this is a good way to proceed, or the best under the circumstances way to proceed. So those are driven regionally, and then
using
also
the high number, 255,000.
The policy is, since it's a regional route, do we have the bus, for example, if it's coming down Southern, if we were to choose not to participate, the bus would stop at Price Road,
turn around
and go back.
Correct.
Yes. And that's really our policy decision: is do we want the bus to stop at Price Road, or do we want to continue on into Mesa through the completion of its route? That's really the policy decision. If we decide it's going to continue on, we can't decide that only half the buses are going to stop.
Don't change the head.
Right.
Yeah, you're going to, what the region decides, we're going to either accept,
we'll go the other way,
and let them go in, or if we want to have more, then it's going to stop going west at Price Road and turn around and stay in Mesa. But really, if it's a regional route, we either need to decide if we're in the game or if we're out of the game. We can't pick and choose when the route is, because that's a joint decision that's made between Mesa, Tempe, and Phoenix on the Southern route, because those are the three cities that it impacts, right?
Yes. Okay. The only service that's entirely Mesa that we're talking about is the link.
Yeah, even Power Road is a Mesa is a regional route. It's a Mesa Gilbert route. So, you know, I mean,
well, what about the dial rate issues? Are those Mesa issues? So the link and
well,
the,
there are Mesa issues that are really affected by regional issues.
Well, yeah,
but let's get back so we can. So on the regional issues, we're going to decide whether we're either with the regional program or not with the regional program. Is that a way to boil that down?
Yes.
Okay, I'm going to make it as simple as possible. Boy, we can make this real complicated.
We are.
And my brain can't handle that. I want to make it as simple as possible. So what we're deciding is we're either in or out on the regional stuff. And as far as the new service, we're deciding whether we want to delay the new service either 6 months or a year. The staff has suggested delaying implementation of service 6 months, and then also some other Mesa-only service cuts or service adjustments, I would say, service adjustments that would make up the difference, and that'll get us to the $1.3 million. Is that accurate?
Yes.
That's accurate.
Okay.
Mayor, and you talked about a hybrid model. I mean, it really has come down to this. You could conceivably come very close to closing the budget shortfall just by delaying the implementation of new service.
Right.
You could do that for the entire year.
If you went for the entire year, you pick up $1 million of the $1.3 million just from
1.2 of the 1.3 could be saved by delaying the implementation of new service.
I'm missing something, because you have here, if you delay it a year, it's a million. Oh, I'm sorry.
Plus
2.1. And with the Arizona Avenue.
With
also.
Arizona
gotcha.
Avenue.
Okay,
I gotcha. Exactly.
The link.
But
that's a Chandler Mesa kind of a deal. Unlike our link is purely Mesa, this is a Chandler Mesa.
Absolutely.
Deal. Okay.
So you're impacting Chandler.
And we are.
And what does Chandler say about that?
They're waiting for October.
They've already signed off on October. We're still having discussions about January. Our biggest concern about implementing service prior to January is all of the stations and other capital improvements to Arizona Avenue and Country Club won't be complete until December. And so we believe that in light of that, it would be both responsible and better for the riders to wait until all of those.
So once again, really the difference is $100,000.
Yes.
Because we're gonna either go with the October $100,000 saving or the January. So really the difference in us pushing Chandler, because Chandler really wants October, we could live with January. So really the difference is what we're looking at.
$100,000.
Is it worth it for us $100,000 to basically be at odds with our regional partner?
Mayor, I wouldn't necessarily classify it as or describe it as being at odds right now. We've had some conversations with Chandler at various levels, and there's been conflicting views. Obviously, their transit staff is very excited about getting this new service in as soon as possible. at other levels of the city, they have varying views about waiting a little bit later. So we're continuing that discussion.
But once again, that's $100,000 out of $1.3 million.
It's $100,000, and because it's new service, we're not under the tight federal restrictions of making a decision today, as we are with some of the other routes that are existing.
And even if we only delayed 6 months and delayed 3 months, we're at $600,000. We're half of our gap. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's jump real quick to Dial-A-Ride, because how does that fit in with this, with the $1.3 million? Because you got two options here. One's $230,000. One's almost $800,000. And it looks to me like if you went with the option A on Dial-A-Ride and the 6 month delay on that, you've bridged your gap. So I guess I'm oversimplifying this. Yeah, how does this fit in?
And Mayor, before Mike goes through that, let me just say, the budget recommendation that Mike has brought forward envisions closing the gap without taking into account cost savings from Dial-A-Ride. Now, we're about to talk about how we can garner some cost savings, because we think it's important moving forward. Back to this structural issue we now have into the future, we think that there has to be changes to the program in order to help balance our budget in the future, or help us close that gap.
So what we're talking, and that's what I wanted to get to, what we're talking about now are savings that are over and above your plan to bridge the $1.3 million.
That's correct.
They're not included in getting to the million, 1.3. They're saying if we did nothing to Dial-A-Ride, and let's assume for discussion purposes that Dial-A-Ride stayed the same from a cost standpoint. We know that in many ways we can't control Dial-A-Ride costs, because it all is dependent upon how many calls we get. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody calls, we got to answer. And unlike a bus, where you have a fixed cost, Dial-A-Ride is almost purely variable. Because it's it's mostly dependent upon how many calls you get. And we know that in the last year, for example, one of the problems we had was our Dial-A-Ride calls really spiked. They were unanticipated because of the economy. It's sort of an inverse relationship. So you're saying that 1.3 is covered with previous recommendations. What we're going to talk about now are incremental.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but it goes back to that structural issue. Right. If you can find a recurring solution that you don't have to solve for the one-time fixes.
Gotcha.
So this is something to look forward to, so maybe you don't have to keep coming back.
Well, I just want to put it in perspective, because it's a little confusing as whether you have to have these or don't have to have these. If we stick with the lane and doing all the change you have, then it puts it in a different context for where Dial-A-Ride is, to me at least. I don't know if it is to anyone else, but at least I know where my starting point is.
Right, and I think that, yes, it covers that in the memo that talks about that at the end there, yes.
Not everyone has the memo in front of them.
Yeah, so I'm just
saying.
That's
what I wanted to go through.
Yeah, no, that's the point.
Well, we do, but I mean, all those out there don't have it. So that's why I wanted to put it in perspective for the discussion. Okay.
Okay. Moving forward, in further discussions and looking at the Dial-A-Ride program, we really boiled it down to two alternatives. One is the federal minimum. We've talked about this time and again with you. That would be reducing to the ADA minimum service area, which, as you know, excludes large areas of the city. We're not recommending that at this time, but we do want to show what the savings are if we were going to do that in the overall program. Alternative B, what we're calling ADA and limited premium, this limited premium would apply to people outside the three-quarter mile rule, where they would pay their $3 fare plus $1 for each mile that it took to get them back inside the three-quarter mile area. Valley Metro has done some updated research scrubbing through the data, and they've found that the estimated average fare for those 28,000 people would be $5.25. We've got an estimated ridership loss, where we think we'll probably lose about 6,490 trips. Again, this is estimated. Its approach, we think it starts
Mike,
getting...
Mike, if you could expand on that a little bit. When you say trips lost, what exactly does that mean?
We believe that these are trips that will either divert to an alternative program, coupons for cabs, or they'll find a way to get within the three-quarter mile area or not use the system. So, in further discussing this, some ideas came out, and really, you know, those trips outside the three-quarter-mile area, we can actively manage those more than the unfunded mandate areas, as been mentioned before. We could look at a hardship exemptions for medical or grocery trips. We could do a zone fee if that was something, or we could look at alternative delivery methods, either specialized cab program like we have with our dialysis, or something like similar to the old special transportation services. So the point I'm making some of those is we, with our working group with Valley Metro, we're actually looking at these and trying to develop additional options. It's just we're not ready to bring those forward right now.
Yeah. Councilman Higgins.
Just a general question about dial-a-ride in general. Is there an option that the city can opt out entirely if we provide a different service model for the whole city? And if so, have we ever looked at that? Because I we all know how expensive the dial-a-ride option is. Someone's making money somewhere, and I would think we as a city could do this cheaper,
I'll say
better service.
You could do, it could be all run by cabs, a cab program or a cab service. It doesn't necessarily have to be that dial-a-ride vehicle. In fact, one of the questions that came up in the past is, when did dial-a-ride start in Mesa, and how is it run? Well, Jim Wright at Valley Metro found the actual article of when it started, July 5th, 1977.
And you have the actual newspaper?
Yeah, there's Mayor Pomeroy there. It started in 1977. It was citywide, and they had 36 riders in the first 4 hours. So we see where it's gone since then.
So that is an option. We as a city could opt out of the...
I won't say opt out. We could provide it in a different method.
Let me ask you this, though. If we did that, would we still be operating under the same rules we are now as far as the federal?
Yes.
We're not going to change. We can't offer a service model that's exactly the same citywide simply because we have certain baseline... I guess we could. Well, we've done that before. Mm-hmm. But we're required to operate a certain level of service within the three-quarter mile by federal law.
Yes.
East of basically Sossaman, we're not covered by that requirement. And that's really the area that we're talking about that has the real challenges because we have no bus service out there and we have no federal rules. And so we're trying to figure out how to create a service which is somewhat uniform within the confines of the distance that we have, the service challenges, but also the federal mandates that
east
we have.
Gilbert.
No, east of Power. East of Sossaman.
No, there's entire sections that are east of Gilbert that aren't.
Well, the three-quarter mile requirement.
They have a great map that shows. There's huge sections that are just east of Gilbert that don't
have. Oh, on the northeast part of it. Sure. I see what you're saying. Okay, I see what you're saying.
But what you said and what they have said are two different things. You can have a service model with covering the whole city equally, but not using the dial-a-ride option.
Right, but you have to maintain. You're driven by the federal requirements that require the level of service.
Sure.
We're not saying different things. I'm just saying you can't escape the federal requirements by offering your own service.
No.
You still have to provide service whether you contract it out or whether you do it as a city that meets the federal standards within the coverage area.
Right, but they have shown, where any other service is cheaper than using the dial-a-ride, right? Dial-a-ride is a $35 per trip or
$33.75.
And you're saying the average using a cab to pick up one person individually was 18 or something? It was a big cost savings.
The coupons for cabs is $9.72 per trip.
Mayor.
Councilmember Summers.
I had a meeting yesterday with the Regional Public Transit Authority. I was going to say RPTA, but the mayor would gig me for an acronym. So I can use it now, right? RPTA. The RPTA is discussing ADA dial-a-ride issues, particularly in the West Valley. These are initial discussions. They put out an RFP, request for proposals for transit. They're going to put out a new one because some of the companies said, you know, if you allow us to design the system, we could do it for you a lot cheaper and get everything done. Do you have any more information on what they're looking at how that might impact us, and have we looked at potential savings yet? It may be too early for that last part, but
That's a model that we're watching very closely.
Because I don't think anybody else up here has heard about this.
I'll have Julie can describe that probably better.
That's a taxi cab-based model. It is something that is new, and they're still working on. We haven't been given a lot of details on it yet. Right. I think it's still working through the process. Valley Metro seems to feel that this is a very new kind of method, not very traditional, and has some very good merit. From everything that I've heard from the people that were on the panel going through that, they're very excited about it. It would be using taxi company that would probably have something similar in training as we have for our dialysis program, which is a little more specialized training on how to deal with people that are in mobility devices and things like that.
As it was presented to me, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but the way it was presented to me was that there are a company or a number of companies that own not only a taxi cab, but also the medical transportation component as well. And if they were to design their system, a person would call them, and they would be able to determine what level of help they need and send the appropriate level of transportation for that particular individual for the type of travel. So you're not sending a medical transport type of ADA transit if they only need a taxi cab. They send them what they need, and so that overall the bill is then reduced. Does that sound fairly accurate early on to what they're trying to look at?
Yeah, that sounds pretty accurate. One difference that we have here is that we do a lot of shared trips, and that is actually a bit of a savings to us to do that in our current allocation method as to how we're charged. So we, in a sense, get rewarded a little bit for productivity. You know, the more people we have traveling in one vehicle, the slightly lower the fees are for us. In a method like that, it may be able to be worked out, but that would be something that we would have to look at.
Something else that they might have to consider as part of the RFP. But the point of my bringing this up, Mayor, is that there is an interesting development in ADA and paratransit services that may produce a more efficient system and some cost savings. It's too early to tell, but it's worth keeping our eye on.
And Mayor and Councilmember Summers, just to that point, too, we're also looking at that for our local, for our Dollar Ride service, not just in the West Valley, because that's part of what the in-person assessment is going to bring that opportunity. Because once they assess the person face-to-face, they're able to get a better understanding of what their challenges are, and we'll be able, when that person calls up, and Julie can, I'm sure, describe it better than I could, when that person then calls in for Dollar Ride service, understanding the limitations that that person may have and understanding their destination, they'll be able to try to pair together the most cost-efficient method of getting that person from point A to B. So we're hopeful that will also change our system as well.
Yep.
Okay, so where are we?
Moving on to next steps, we have a public meeting for transit service reductions May 25th. We're doing that in concert with Valley Metro and the other East Valley cities. So we'll have all the service reductions that everybody is proposing. We'll get feedback and input from the public. We can then have that available as we come back for our tentative budget adoption on June 7th and then begin initial service changes on July 26th.
So, Mayor, at this point, just to recap where we are, just so everyone's clear, because we've talked about different options, we'll tell you where the staff was as far as recommending that, and then if we hear objections, we can certainly discuss. We'll move forward with items 1 through 9 with the what we're calling the regional service reductions, including keeping the 60-minute Sunday headway along Southern Avenue. We will implement items 10 and 11, which we believe, well, we know 11 is going to happen with the light rail reductions, and 10 is the most conservative estimate that we can utilize on getting on what our cost savings will be off the ADA bus rail pass. We will proceed with partial delay of new service until January on Power Road and on Country Club, Arizona Avenue, and also delay implementation of Sunday service on Gilbert Road. And doing all of those things we just described, we estimate we'll close our budget gap.
And the and with the Dial-A-Ride, what's your proposal right now?
Our proposal is B, to do the $3 fare plus the 1 mile for each mile traveled outside the three-quarter mile area, for a potential savings of $231,000.
Okay, Councilmember Higgins.
Did you just not say that the budget gap is closed with those 1 through 11 and you don't need to do a Dial-A-Ride option?
We are not, Mayor, Councilmember Higgins, we do not need the cost savings this fiscal year to close the budget deficit, but we know with the structural issues that we see looming on the horizon, as in next fiscal year, that going ahead and implementing this so we can get an idea of how this will work will be beneficial for us down the road. In addition to that, I know we've been asked by council to look at some, as Mike described it, hardship exemptions. So it's hard to quantify right now. We know what we would, the cost savings we would garner by adding a premium, but how many people will be eligible for hardship exemptions? What does that make the dollar amount? So we start at $231,000, but if 50% are eligible for hardship exemptions, then that'll be $115,000 around about. So we need to get an idea. So we would like to go ahead and implement that system and get an idea of what type of fiscal impact we may be looking at.
So let me clarify again.
Sure.
So you're saying you do want to implement item B for this fiscal year?
That would be our recommendation.
Right.
10-11.
Yeah.
So,
Mayor and Council,
as I'm hearing it, you want item B as a starting point, but you're also going to be looking at refining that, and I'm expecting that prior to June, you're going to come back to us with some more ideas as far as the zone fees, the alternative delivery, to tweak item B, because you're saying that this can be better, but this is a starting point. This is what you'd like to lay on the table, mm-hmm. and say we're also going to be looking at these refinements to option B.
That's correct.
Is that correct? Okay. Mm-hmm.
And Mayor, I just want to let it be known that I am really opposed to treating the citizens of Mesa differently depending on where they live. So I don't think that it's right to charge one section of Mesa when you're not charging someone else in another section. And I believe that we should be spending some time to find out a different service model for the entire city that would make the cost savings that we're looking for. Thanks.
Yeah, Councilman Fender.
As we anticipate, Mr. Butler, our future calls from our fellow citizens, I'm sure they're going to want to express their appreciation for this new service tomorrow. I hope we take the opportunity to have those our friends at the state level to have their phone numbers ready so they can experience the appreciation and love that's going to come from this. So really appreciate it.
Thank you, Councilmember Fenter. Matter of fact, we should entitle it. We should rename this Dial-A-Ride service reductions the. Forget it. Arizona Legislative Transportation Reductions. Okay.
Mayor.
I'll go last.
Did someone say Mayor?
I did, but go ahead.
Councilmember Summers.
Clarification.
My turn. I was going to say it's to contact council is at Councilmember Fenter. No. He'll forward it. This has been.
I just want to make a point. I mean, we're sort of joking. I don't know that people completely comprehend, and this is two things we brought up today, and I know that our legislature, they comprehend, they're keeping real quiet about what I call the dump down. We're the lowest on the totem pole, and our citizens are getting dumped on by the state. That's just the absolute truth. There are unfunded mandates. There are budgets that are being redirected, and there is a direct impact. And the thing about cities and towns is that we are the ones that deal with the direct impacts to our citizens. They don't have that doesn't happen at the state level, certainly doesn't happen at the federal level like it does with us. You know, we're the ones that if we have to plug a hole here, we can't plug a hole in a street. If we have to do this, we can't do that. Or we got to look for new revenue sources. So I guess there's a little bit of thing that I get a little bit tired of the legislature ignoring the impact, direct impact on citizens, because their actions and sweeping this fund and that fund, I know I don't envy them their position with the budget issues. They have an absolutely horrendous situation and a tough job. But we cannot ignore the fact that they're making decisions that are directly impacting our citizens, and we're dealing with that right now. And we just need to understand that that's why we're dealing with it.
And Mayor, that was exactly what Mike really wanted to stress at the start of this. I know for many of you it wouldn't be budget season if we weren't having a transit discussion, but really the point was that even with a 10% reduction, we were able to live within our means, if not for the actions that the state legislature took.
We made the cuts. We gained the efficiencies. We did what we needed to on our budget, and the thanks we got was a Christmas gift in April.
Exactly.
Okay. And so I appreciate Councilmember Fenton bringing that up. Councilmember Summers.
Thank you for interrupting me on that, Mayor, because that was a very important point. No, I'm serious. It was a very important point. But for the sweeping of LTAF, we would not be in this position again. And this is now the, I don't know, am I on the third or the fourth time that I've been working on trying to make sure that the citizens of East Mesa receive, particularly the ADA dial-a-ride issue, receive the service that they need and that they deserve. And then in some respects, is they pay that quarter-cent sales tax for transit, too. That's Maricopa County-wide. And yet, because they don't have a bus route near them, not only do they not have a bus route to access for their transit issues or transit needs, they're potentially shut out of other transit needs. And there are significant retirement communities in this area that have needs, and they're taxpayers, too. But transit is another issue that's extremely important to this community, and I think our voters have demonstrated that a number of ways. It provides access to employment for many folks, whether that they need transit or not, whether they take their car, some take the bus. I'm going to be taking the train here to a meeting in a few hours if we ever get past this meeting. We've used transit for economic development in the future. Light rail is part of that. The vice mayor and the mayor have been very actively engaged, particularly Vice Mayor Kyle Jones, very actively engaged in providing new transit service, but also how are we going to create economic development around that. The mayor's been looking at new transit options in regional commuter rail as a possibility as this community continues to grow. It provides a benefit of a reduction on the use of foreign oil. You start taking a trip on the bus, you're utilizing the light rail, you reduce our demand for oil and gas, and that reduces our dependence on foreign oil. And in the spirit of why I'm wearing this ridiculous green tie with this very nice black suit is for, I don't know, Tree Day, Earth Day?
Earth.
You know, I mean, that's the low-hanging fruit of mass transit is it reduces pollution. The mayor also was correct in that when you look at transit expansion, we don't want it. We really need it. It is an integral part of the Mesa Gateway area and development out there. It is necessary for the development and expansion of the Power Road Knowledge Corridor. Businesses are looking not only for access to freeways, but what kind of access to transit they have. It is an economic development tool as much as anything else. We have ASU, AAT Still, MCC Red Mountain, Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport, ASU Poly. All of those are unserved or underserved by transit right now. And the cuts that we are looking at are really citywide. We're leaving off East Mesa. We're cutting back in West Mesa. I don't know how much farther we can go. The mayor had suggested
at, you know, we might have to find a new revenue source. But how do we find a new revenue source in these trying times? Because people don't have a lot of money. It's a matter of shifting. So maybe there is some room to shift around in the budget if the voters so feel that we should do that. In 2006, the voters approved a 3/10 sales tax dedicated for street maintenance. The original concept of that sales tax was that it would be a transportation tax, that perhaps buses and rail would be a part of that. But the will of the voters at the time, it seemed, the temperature was that transit wasn't really a need. Things have changed since 2006. Even in my district, where we felt that roads were only important, we now feel that. I can't tell you how many calls I field from folks in Sunland Village who say, when are you going to finally extend the light rail out to the Phoenix Mesa Gateway Airport? Well, that's a long time coming. But it shows that there is an interest in a greater focus on transit for all the needs that I discussed. When you look at that 3 cents of a sales tax, if you took 1/6 of that, 0.05, 1/6 of that would raise about $3 million a year. If we could use up to 1/6 of that, 0.05 of that, it's not a new tax, just redirect it, the same tax we collect now, and direct it to funding, we could fund the expansions we're looking at, preserve much of the service that we're talking about, and make sure that the $88 ride is met, and MCC could also be served as well. What I would like to see, if it is the will of the council, Mayor, is that we hear a presentation on what. Now, there is an impact to this, Mayor. You're right. That 3/10 of a sales tax is used for streets. So we have a street maintenance project, and we're catching up. So it's going to impact how long it takes to get caught up. I would like to see a presentation by the transit staff and what the impact would be taking $3 million out of that fund, how it's going to stretch that out, how long it will take to catch up. That we could still catch up would be important, and that perhaps if it's acceptable to the council, we could move forward to the voters in November asking them for the authorization to use that amount of money for transit, up to that amount of money for transit. And do we have time to put that on the ballot? When do we have to make that decision?
120 days. I have to ballot language.
Okay, so we're good on time, ma'am?
It's approximately early July.
Early July. So we have time. We don't have a lot of time. But if it's your will, Mayor, that's what I would like to hear that presentation. Thank you.
Okay.
Mayor, what we'll do then as it relates to Dollar Ride, there's a lot of unanswered questions that we need to do as far as the hardship waivers. I just clarified with Mike and Julie, in order to institute any changes, we only need locally a 30-day advance notice of that. We'll have some different milestones coming up that we'll be able to come back to council, report on maybe how this would work, and even if we're not able to start July 1 on this, we would still... Yeah.
And
like
I think you've laid something on the table, which is different than what we've seen before. I want to stress that this is merely a proposal, a starting point, so that tomorrow morning we don't read Mesa does this. No, this is open for discussion. I appreciate you throwing something out that's unique and different. You've heard some feedback, and you've said that you even recognize that there's some tweaking, and I think you got that from talking to individual council members as you were reviewing this before this meeting. And so I'm anxious to see what you come back with as far as refining the proposal that's on the table, taking into account what you've heard this morning. We'll talk some more, because it's certainly not going to, what Councilmember Summers is talking about, involves more than just the transit department. It involves several city departments, specifically streets, and they have a very well established and well defined maintenance program right now that we'd have to look at. So we'll follow up and get back with you on that as to when we can talk about that.
Is the council interested in at least looking in that direction?
Is there any other sentiment to at least hear a presentation on something like that?
I'm always good for information. Too much information.
So we'll Mr. Brady, we'll pull together the streets and Mr. Clevenger and transit and all that, and see what kind of impact that might have.
They're scheduled to come for council next week or so, I think, anyway.
And that may be a little too early to talk about it, but let's
We'll plug it in. We'll figure it out.
You'll understand. Yeah.
We'll understand where we're headed. Okay? All right. Any other questions? Hey, thanks so much. This is, as always,
it's
gobs of
fun.
Let's do it again soon, okay?
Thank you.
We promise.
All righty. Okay, the next item on the agenda, to hear reports on meetings and our conferences attended. Do we have any reports? Okay.
You did, your four committees.
Oh, that's right. Thank you, Vice Mayor. Tuesday, a couple nights ago, we had the privilege, when I say we, most of the council, I think Councilmember Summers had a conflict and Councilmember Richards had a conflict. The rest of us were... at a reception for those citizens who have volunteered to serve on our citizen boards and advisory committees, and we really appreciate the work they do and enjoyed the opportunity to get together with them, many of whom I have not met personally until that night because they've been serving on the board since before I took office, and so I really appreciated that. So thanks to all of our citizens, and thank you to the Vice Mayor and Council Members Fenter and Kavanaugh and Higgins for being there. Councilmember Summers.
Thank you, Mayor. I very much wanted to be there for that, given the efforts you and I have put into trying to increase service and volunteerism from folks out in District 6. I appreciate your efforts. But in lieu of that, I was representing Mesa at the Aviation Week MRO conference. I know I'm using an acronym. I can't remember what MRO stands for, Mayor. It's you're the pilot. You know what? It's for maintenance of aircraft. We have a Hawker Beechcraft. I think it's doing a ribbon cutting today. We had a lot of MROs coming to Phoenix to look at, to attend a conference and look at Mesa as a possible site for more jobs and more activity. So it was, I was proud to be there. Yeah, more service centers. Great.
Good.
Yeah.
Councilmember Richens.
The opportunity yesterday to attend the Arizona Transit Association conference and speak on a panel about collaborations and different partnerships that are emerging in the transit world and in government.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Brady.
Thank you, Mayor. Reminder to the Public Safety Committee meeting, we have a meeting right after this one. And also this Saturday, April 24th, will be MACFest. It will be the last one for the season from 10 to 4 p.m. We'll have a study session on April 29th. Also, a reminder to the council that same evening, April 29th, there's a joint meeting of Mesa Public Schools and the city that will be held. Also wanted to let council know, I think you noticed today, we City of Mesa employees sponsored a bike to work day, which was very timely. And our celebration of Earth Day, because on yesterday, Forbes magazine came out with America's best cities for bikers, and Mesa was ranked number 10 in the country. So congratulations to the City of Mesa. Thank you.
Thank you. I think they're just trying to make up for when they tried to call us boring. Bikers are not boring.
Is that because of the, like, Chosa's Harley-Davidson and stuff?
I think that's what it is.
Yeah.
I think that's what they meant.
Downtown. Chester's. It's Chester's now.
They're just number one.
Yeah.
Okay.
Move on.
Anything else? Ms. Carker, do we have any requests to speak from the public?
No requests, Mayor.
Okay. Entertain a motion. We have a motion from the Vice, from Councilmember Summers, a second.
The Vice.
From Vice Mayor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. We are adjourned.